Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Cynical Podcast, coming to you from the definitive China happy hour at the 18th Street Lounge here in Washington, D.C. Let's hear you folks make a little noise. That is more than a little noise. That's excellent. I mean, I'm going to have to like recalibrate my microphones after that. I am Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by Jeremy Fire and Fury Goldcorn. And, you know, he is a podcast host the likes of whom the world has never seen. Fire and Fury is what he's going to bring down on any of yous out there who DC is chatting when you should be listening to our podcast. So, how are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing very well. Delighted to be here in my adoptive nation's capital.
Meijing, as I call it. You guys should pick up the word. It's called Meijing, right? American capital. All right. Jeremy, of course, is editor-in-chief of SubChina, and SubChina, of course, is the best way to stay on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day with Jeremy's meticulously assembled free daily newsletter and, of course, our app and at the website subchina.com. It is truly a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We want to say some thank yous.
Yeah, at this point, we are going to repeat our thanks to Winslow Robertson for putting this together and hosting us here in D.C. Let's hear it for not only Winslow, but his entire team. Thank you very, very
thank
much
you,
for
Winslow.
Bringing us
yeah.
here.
Yeah. And, of course, DeMorian and his excellent outfit, the U.S.-China Strong Foundation, and to Nat Ahrens and the American Mandarin Society. The American Mandarin Society teaches you to speak Mandarin, but probably not of the sort of Mandarin that we're going to teach you tonight. You will see what we're talking about in just a little bit. We also want to thank the Young China Watchers. Yeah, Young China Watchers are some excellent folks. And the D.C. China Society. Yeah, let's get up.
That will sound perfect in the show that goes on the website.
The editing magic, the magic of my editing. So it is just the two of us today, which is a rare thing, but we'd love to take your questions toward the end, and we will leave time for that if possible. Jeremy, why don't you introduce our topic for the evening?
So if any of you read our daily email newsletter or our website, you may have seen something we published recently, a full translation with some explanations of what is reported to be Xinhua News Agency's updated style guide, which tells the state news agency's reporters and editors what words and phrases they should and maybe more importantly should not use. Today we're going to talk about this rather remarkable and revealing list.
Yes, there are many reasons why this list is so significant and so deserving of a close look. When I first encountered it, what immediately came to mind was this old saw I often heard from historians, from people talking about the practice of studying history. And they used to say that when you are studying an ancient society and you find all over these injunctions not to do this or not to do that, you can be pretty sure of one thing, that people in that society at that time did that. If it's don't do such and such, you can be pretty sure people were doing such and such. For example, do you see a lot of signs around Washington, D.C. that say, do not spit on the ground? No, you do not. But where do you see a lot of signs that say, do not spit? Right. So you get the idea. But you see them all over the place, right? So.
More than that, just like lists of censored words do, the style guide that we're going to talk about gives you a great idea of what the insecurities are, where the red lines are. And these include everything from sensitivities about how Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Macau are talked about to dirty words.
So we're going to take a look at this Xinhua style guide today, updated. First, Jeremy, I guess I want to ask you first. How do we know that this document is authentic? What leads us to suspect that this is actually not just some clever forgery or a
Well,
fake?
We don't absolutely, but there are a few signs. Firstly, it was circulated widely on WeChat and Weibo, social media accounts of many people that I know work as journalists in state media. It hasn't been deleted from WeChat and other social media platforms. The level of detail about political issues is much more than you would expect from a spoof. And with attention to things that if you were just writing a spoof to take the piss out of Xinhua, you probably wouldn't include. And then finally, the guidelines actually comport with what you see in Xinhua news agencies' reports. And I should just explain, I think this is a pretty China-savvy crowd, but just to make sure everyone is aware, Xinhua is the biggest Chinese state-owned central news agency. It's the source of authorized copy, free copy for Chinese newspapers and websites across the country, and sometimes compulsory copy because when certain events happen, various propaganda authorities will say use only authorized copy to talk about this news event, and that usually means Xinhua.
So let's offer an overview of the style guide itself. I mean, the list, with all its injunctions, all its do's and don'ts, all its verboten words, is organized into different categories. There's politics and law, which includes the 38 vulgar phrases that you will all be delighted to learn about tonight. I think this is really the reason why Jeremy wanted to do this, just so he could say naughty words in front of a crowd of people. There's a long section on law, which we'll delve into in some detail. A section on religion and ethnicity, one on Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, and the issues of territory and sovereignty, and finally one on international relations. But I've tended to think of it instead in terms of a different couple of categories, in terms of first, politically correct words, which actually, you know, show, I think, an increasing sensitivity about things like minority nationalities or the disabled or, you know, generally avoiding being an asshole in the way that you speak. And then there's correct party speak, which is, you know, that is keeping, you know, your use of language, the way that you deploy phrases, in line with official party ideology. And then there's good old dirty words. Of course, the compilers didn't conceive of it this way. But Jeremy, do you think, I think that let's talk about these politically correct words first. I mean, there's an awful lot of them, and they span a bunch of the different categories. Do you think that they kind of represent progress in some way?
Well, I think there is an aspect of progress that you can see in terms of the fact that wanting to use a more polite word to describe people who have physical handicaps, who are of different ethnicity or nationality, is certainly a sign that, you know, a society is starting to care about people who may be more marginalized. And that is progress.
Yeah, so maybe we should send this over to Pennsylvania Avenue, right? Let them learn about this. So, I mean, for example, for the physically disabled, you're not supposed to use the offensive terms like one-eyed dragon or duyanlong or xiazi or longzi for the deaf or shazi and you're not supposed to say retarded, like ruozhi. Instead, you're supposed to use stuff like, you know, mangren for the vision impaired or the hearing impaired, longren, or the mentally disabled, you know. Anyway, this is the idea. You're also not supposed to emphasize a certain group of people or an identity in news reporting. So you're not supposed to say, for example, when reporting about disasters, there's a student from Peking University among the victims. The others are just ordinary people. Although, you know, I noticed that the Hong Kong press was talking about the earthquake and saying, you know, hundreds dead in earthquake in Zhuozhaigou, including five people from Hong Kong.
Yeah. But they weren't following the Xinhua rules.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the terms, offensive terms for minorities. So the list includes a prohibition on using words like huihui for the hui minority or manzi for the same group. For Mongolian people, you shouldn't use Mengzu, you should say Mengguzu, you know. So there is an attempt to take out some of the language that you do hear quite a lot in China, but take it out from official media reports.
Yeah, and you're not supposed to use insulting expressions in colloquial language. For example, you know, you're not supposed to say, as an insult, Mongolian doctors, you know, Mongol daifu, which really means quack daifus. You're not supposed to call quack doctors Mongolian doctors, which is progress. I think you'll agree. And Mongolism, of course, you know, people who have Down syndrome are not to be referred to as Mongols or Mongoloids, right? So progress, right?
Yeah, indeed. There's also, interestingly, a lot about Muslims and Islam. You know, almost an outsized section, I think, of the style guide is devoted to how you talk about Muslim people.
And that's really interesting because recently in China, Islamophobia, the fear over so-called halalization, has been a big talking point online. A lot of people are worried that, you know, all 21 million Muslims in China's ridiculous, you know, 1.4 billion people are somehow going to, you know, force everyone to stop eating pork. It's a strange form of Islamophobia that has sort of taken over in China in a lot of chat rooms. You know, some of it hides behind this veneer of atheism. Right? Just it says, well, you know, the Communist Party is an atheist party, and then therefore there should be no sort of gentle treatment of different minority nationalities. We talked about this at length on a show that actually, Jeremy, you had to sit that one out. I mean, it was Ada Shen and I talked to Alice Su and to Ma Tianjie, who is a terrific blogger based in Beijing, about rising Islamophobia in China. And I would urge all of you to check out that podcast, which goes into that subject in some depth. But there is an awful lot, yeah, that deals with Islam here, including, you know, the way that you refer to Islamic countries. You're not supposed to call them Muslim countries or refer to the Muslim world. You say instead Islamic countries or the Islamic world, and you're supposed to, you know, be respectful to how countries define themselves. For example, even though Indonesia is a Muslim majority country, it does not refer to itself as an Islamic state. So we have to be very careful about that. So, you know, I think we should move into some of the law ones that I think those are really interesting. Because, again, maybe is this an area where there's progress?
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
who's to say?
Don't force me into too much optimism.
That's hard.
But let's talk about the law. So one of the things I found most interesting is that the style guide demands that you do not basically take sides between a plaintiff and a defendant in a court case. And it also talks about how you have to refer to people who are suspected of a crime as a suspect, not a criminal.
Right.
Which and I mean, this is pretty normal. This is, you know, for a style guide in, you know, for most news organizations anywhere. But I don't know when this was inserted into the Xinhua style guide. It could have been this most recent update. I couldn't track down a copy of the previous update, but I believe it's sometime in the last few years. And there does seem to be an effort for at least the state media to treat the courts as impartial, even if we all know. Is there a problem up there? Oh. Even if we all know that, you know, courts in China, if you're a suspect, your chances of not being convicted may not be all that great. But at least the state media now is instructed to treat you as innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Maybe they seem to have taken clues from maybe the way that the American media writes about criminal proceedings.
Yeah,
that seems to be in evidence to me, at least. Another strange feature of this is that it seems to have been layered. You can kind of look into this thing and see kind of sedimentary layers that were laid down in previous versions of it. They have some kind of odd pop culture anachronisms in there. The people who I think a lot of younger Chinese people wouldn't even remember. For example, who remembers Li Yuchun? Okay, yeah, you do. Okay, so now, but not everyone.
No, really. Can we have a proper show of hands? How many people know who Li Yuchun is?
Oh, that's not bad.
How many people know what a Yumi is?
Besides him, how many people know Jin Yumi is?
So yeah, there's this great section in the banned words, which specifically mentions Yumi. Do not use words like Yumi to refer to celebrities like Li Yuchun. So if you don't know Li Yuchun, she was the winner of the 2006 Mongolian Supergirl
yogurt
voice competition. You know, it was the first sort of America's Got Talent show in China that went really, really big. And all of the stars, the final four finalists, I guess, had these groups of fans who gave themselves funny names. So, like, Li Yuchun, because of the Yu, her fans were called Yumi, because, you know, Mi is like a pun on fan. So these terms are specifically banned. Don't use words like this to refer to entertainers unless you have to because of the context, and then put them in quote marks.
And there were other ones like 粉丝, which is another word for fans, right? So you couldn't call fans of Guo Degang. Who's Guo Degang? Of course, he's the Xiangsheng artist, right? He's a really, really popular one. But again, from some years ago, but you know, they're saying you can't use words like 港丝, which is like a way to refer to Guo Degang fans.
Perhaps this is also a good time to talk about the dirty words.
Right.
Because that's what I really want to talk about. And the reason why I'd like to talk about this is there's a really interesting artifact in this style guide that also comes from an earlier period, 2009, on Baidu. This company, this little company you may have heard of, they have an encyclopedia like Wikipedia called Baidu Baike. And somebody wrote an entry about the 10 legendary beasts of Baidu. So that these beasts were all puns, and they many of them were dirty words. Like, the easiest one to get if you don't speak Chinese is the fuck yo, which is the is a squid.
And then there's the cao ni ma.
And the cao ni ma.
The grass mud horse, right.
Which is a pun on something, you do something to your mother that one doesn't ordinarily do to one's mother. And I think that's the only one of these 10 beasts that has actually lasted.
Yeah, but it's weird because there were other ones like the he xie, the river crab, right?
Yeah, and the river crab didn't make it into the
It didn't make it into the list this time. List. And, what was the river crab? That was a pun on what? On harmonization, right?
Yeah.
So it was sort of a reference to censorship.
But the cao ni ma is definitely worth remembering, because the image that was associated with it was a llama
or
an alpaca. Some people say it must be an alpaca, not a llama, but the funny looking South American animal. And
sort of
that symbol remains, at least for slightly older people. I think, you know, people born in the 80s and 90s, maybe not so much, but old people like us, think of the grass mud horse as a symbol of opposing censorship.
Like, yeah, so I remember I worked at Baidu for many years, as many of you know, and walking around, you would often see people with these little stuffed plushy alpacas on their desks, and you know what that meant. It was like a raised fist of defiance in the form of a plushie. The cao ni ma.
And there are plenty of other dirty words, which you can find on our website. And, this is a family podcast, so I'm not going to explain all of them in too much detail. But there are words for anal sex, which you're not allowed to use, slang for anal sex. There are a variety of words involving your mother. Apparently, none of these are acceptable to be used in official Xinhua news stories. But it is rather interesting that they went to such a great length of detail to describe these dirty words. Because if you look in the AP style book, or the New York Times house style guide, or you don't generally see an extensive list of slang words for vaginas and penises. But Xinhua somehow felt the need to do this. And my explanation of this is that what happened in, the first decade of the 21st century was all the Chinese state media organizations had to hire a lot of young people who knew how to work the internet. And many of these young people, they were kind of digital natives. And, when they saw slang words, and often very dirty words, they didn't necessarily have a reaction that this should not be in a newspaper, because they'd been reading, their QQ instant messaging feed, their entire adolescence, not Xinhua copy. And I think that's why there's so many dirty words in, because they must have, editors must have been finding them in their stories and having to get rid of them.
I know I have a lot of trouble with this at home. I mean, my kids have these very clever ways of finding ways to almost swear in Chinese. Like, you know, they will refer to... Well, I'm not going to say it. I can't say it without getting myself in trouble here. I'll have to beep it anyway. But I think it's the international relations section, I think, is really fascinating. There's some great examples in there from which you can sort of see how China treats a lot of these other groups within other countries or other countries themselves. You can actually infer an awful lot about this from them. For example, you're not supposed to refer to Hamas, which is, of course, the ruling party in occupied Palestine, a terrorist group or an extremist group. You're never allowed to refer to the former Soviet Union. Just use Soviet Union. I'm not sure what does that mean? Why can't you say 前苏联?
Because you don't want to draw attention to the dissolution of a communist country, would be my reading of it.
Right. And you're not supposed to call the civil armed forces in eastern Ukraine, you're not supposed to call them pro-Russian armed forces in Ukraine or separatists, which is odd because they are pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine who are seeking separate.
But Xinhua doesn't want to push Putin's buttons. Also, it's in the slang section, but international relations, India comes up. So one of the terms you're not allowed to use is a slang word that you find on the Chinese internet for India, which
what is that?
Let me Fu Shiguo. Ah, no, somebody knows it. So Fu Shiguo is the country of floating corpses, referring to the corpses that float down the Ganges River. And you can find this word on the Chinese internet as a kind of derogatory word for India.
Right. They didn't think it was necessary to include the word that I just heard somebody say in the audience, which is an ethnic slur against Indians. But it was interesting that given what's happening right now in Dolkham in Bhutan, that this would be included in the list. One of the interesting ones, another one that just comes to mind, is you're not allowed to refer to the Belt and Road Initiative as the Belt and Road Strategy, not a 战略. And this is one of those ones that I think is peculiar to the Chinese language, because what is the 战 in 战略? What does that mean? War, right. So it connotes a militaristic strategy. So the Belt and Road Initiative is peaceful, obviously, and it must not ever connote any bellicosity, must never hint at any bellicosity. That one, it makes a pretty obvious sense to me, yeah?
Yeah, it makes sense. My favorite, aside from the dirty words, I think, is something that I'm pretty sure is an addition of the most recent revision. And this revision basically is a destruction of the slogan legacy of Hu Jintao. So one of Hu Jintao, I think his major contribution to the great tradition of Communist Party slogans.
And what a great tradition it is.
The eight honors and the eight disgraces. Barong Bachir, who remembers that? Yeah? Some, only three of you. Eight honors and eight disgraces. I spent so many years of my life
trying to memorize them.
Yeah. So
you spent 8 years of your life trying to commit all eight of the disgraces.
So, I mean, the eight honors and disgraces was a list of behaviors that you should model yourself after and that, you know, negative examples that you shouldn't follow that came out under Hu Jintao, which was a kind of a very weak attempt to impose some morality on the party, I think, to a great extent, you know. So you shouldn't be, live an excessively luxurious lifestyle. You should be thrifty. You should be diligent. You shouldn't be lazy, you know, stuff like this.
So
well, that's gone.
Basically, this is Xi Jinping saying, grass mud horse, you.
Yeah, out with the eight honors and disgraces. They didn't completely destroy it. It says instead of using the eight honors and eight disgraces, call it fulfill the socialist concept of honor and disgrace. But in practice, nobody even uses that.
That rolls off the tongue just so much better after all, doesn't it? Jerry, what do you want? Should we take some questions?
I think it's about time.
Yeah,
I think
that would
just
be more
one
fun.
More thing I'd like to mention
okay,
before we
we'll
take questions, which is a lot about Hong Kong and Taiwan. And if you follow, you know, Hong Kong and Taiwan issues, it's worth a look. And sort of the heart of it, I think, is in one sentence, which says, differentiate national frontier, so Guojing, and customs boundary. So, you know, because when you go to an airport in China, the Hong Kong flights, the Macau flights go together with the international flights, and you have to go through passport control and customs. But this is very awkward because they're not other countries. They're not supposed to be other countries. So the Xinhua idea is to use various words to continually indicate that these are not different countries. And in some ways, the heart of it is you don't call it a border. You call it a customs boundary.
I think the whole point of tonight's little discussion, this short discussion, is just how important it is to parse the language and how much information you can actually get from what is not allowed, just as much as you can get from what's actually proactively said. And in when a document like this appears, another that I would point to is if you don't already read it, the China Digital Times, I think Anne from the China Digital Times is here in the audience, yeah, they published this outstanding thing called the Directives from the Ministry of Truth, which purports to be, and I think it quite accurately reflects what is the words that are actually banned or directives that are given to media organizations in the way that they report. And they put this out quite regularly. It's a fascinating way to track what's on the mind. It's like the equivalent of reading Donald Trump's tweets. It's really important, an important way to follow.
Jeremy, would it be even a bit anti-Semitic to point out that your beard is now looking almost rabbinical?
Well, coming from you, maybe, but I have to say my father and uncle, who, unlike me, have Jewish mothers and therefore actually Jewish, both said I look like a rabbi. So if they could say it, I think you're okay.
Honorary Jew that I am. Okay. Anyway, I see evidence of deliberate shaping going on, and that's a fair sight better than it was the last time I saw you. I'm going to assume that that has something to do with a certain orange-handled grooming device that you now possess.
It does indeed. It does indeed. I had lost my razor, and just that's why I started growing a beard. But Harry's sent us
to the rescue.
To the rescue. Beautiful orange razors.
I am loving mine. It's keeping everything nice and neat. On a recent road trip I had with Fan Fan and the kids, every time Johnny caught sight of a flash of orange, he'd start urging me to shave the whole damn thing off. But you know, I've made peace with the fact that I'm never going to grow out this full luscious Lord Guan length beard, but hopefully I can at least have the respectable facial hair of a minor warlord of the Three Kingdoms period.
So, dear listeners, get a great shave at a fair price, like the over 3 million guys who have already switched over to Harry's from their expensive corporate razors.
Claim your free trial offer from Harry's today. It's a $13 value for free when you sign up. You need only to cover shipping. In my case, that was $3. So
that includes a weighted razor with 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and the little trimmer blade on top that Kaiser likes so much.
Yes, I do like that little trimmer slip. But you also get some rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover.
To get your free trial, just go to harrys.com/supchina. That's harrys.com/supchina right now.
Hey, and thanks very much. And now back to the show.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do is we're going to have anyone who has questions is invited to come up to the front here. And ask away. Try to keep them fairly short and snappy and not so insulting. And please refrain from using the 38 banned words. Don't be shy, people. Come on up. Come on up. Yes, sir. Speak into that microphone right there so that we can capture your mellifluous voice on tape.
Bill Jones, I'm with Executive Intelligence Review. It's a magazine, weekly magazine. Somebody told me that I've never seen your program before, and somebody told me you got to look at Seneca because that's the way to really learn about China.
Well, thank you.
I'm very disappointed. I mean, I understand your take on things, but it seems to me I've worked for 40 years now on the issue of trying to create a program for the development of third world countries. I've worked with Indira Gandhi. I've worked with President Portillo in Mexico to try and create a system in which these countries could have the option for developing. And it's always been opposed by the powers that be. It's always been shot down.
Hmm.
But now with China and the Belt and Road Initiative, which I call an initiative, is creating the greatest development program in the world. And the reason they call it an initiative and not a strategy is that although China benefits from it, they create good neighbors, they create goodwill, they create, you know, their soft power, it is open to everybody. And every time President Xi Jinping comes here to the United States, he says to President Trump, but he said to President Obama, you should be a part of this. You should be a part. Maybe we could do infrastructure here in the United States so people could get from Washington to New York.
And instead you get a lot of sneering, right? Right? Instead you get a lot of sniping and people making fun of it. And
The issue is that I understand your take on China. Look, I followed China's politics for a long time.
I don't know that you can.
I know a lot of the crazy things that are going on. But this initiative and this directionality, right,
let me cut you off and riff on this for a little while. I totally agree.
I think you should give it.
That's right. So I totally agree with you on this. And in fact, if you would listen to the last podcast that we recorded about the Belt and Road Initiative, this point was driven home very, very solidly. We all, I think, Jeremy, you would certainly agree, think that there should be less sneering about it and that people should understand. Look, we talked about we had a conversation with Joe Nye at the Kennedy School in Harvard who talked about the Kindleberger trap, which he said was something we should worry about more than the Thucydides trap. The Kindleberger trap, was the disaster, the idea that the disasters of the 1920s and the 30s, leading up to, you know, the rise of fascism and the Holocaust, were the result of the failure of the rising power at the time, the United States, to provide public goods in the world. That was the problem, that the United States should have been trying to supplant the UK's fallen pound as the stable currency, should have been building infrastructure, should have been encouraging global trade, but instead we passed this bugger thy neighbor tariff, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and closed ourselves off, and that's where disaster is. Now we see China, the rising power in the world. Shouldn't we applaud it trying to provide public goods in the world? I think that's where you're going with this, right?
And work with them and do the same
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, they're all making the offer. We should do that. Create good ties.
I absolutely agree with you. Problems. Absolutely agree. Thank you. That's a very astute comment. Come on up.
Hello. My name's Colleen O'Connor. I work for CET Academic Programs for Study Abroad. And I'll bring it back to the original topic of your podcast. Simple question. I'm wondering if these new rules are impacting foreign journalists in China as well, and
no,
their work.
No, this is Xinhua's style guide. So this doesn't even necessarily impact other news organizations. Although one can, you know, if Xinhua is doing it, then it's okay to do for the whole country's media, basically. It won't have any effect on foreign journalists at all. They're just not in the same system.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, who's next?
Hi, I have a question. I have a question about the use of the word initiative instead of strategy. Mm-hmm. Is that more for internal purposes so that Chinese citizens are viewing it as peaceful, or is it more for other nations reading material from China perceiving that as peaceful?
My sense is that it's intended to be external. It's being read. So they are obviously careful about how the name of the, I mean, it was called One Belt, One Road, and people thought that was just a not particularly sonorous name, and so they changed it to the Belt and Road Initiative. Unfortunately, the Belt and Road Forum had an unpleasant acronym, but they're at least trying to communicate the idea better.
And I don't think you dropped that joke. Baff!
Right.
You know, this is an interesting point. I think it also ties in with the gentleman's earlier comment is, you know, that the Chinese Communist Party are very good at a lot of things. But one thing they're not good at all is communicating with foreigners. I mean, they're hopeless. They spend billions and billions on, you know, overseas media, most of which is either ignored or, you know, just laughed at, is the sad truth. And the Belt and Road is a great example of this just in the language, because it's completely counterintuitive. The road is in the sea. The road is the maritime road. the maritime Silk Road. The belt is on the land, you know. They could have just called it the New Silk Road, and it would sound glamorous, it would sound slightly exotic, it would say everything it needed to say about interconnectivity between continents and trade.
Well, to be fair, instead of which, Yidai Lu sounds fine in Chinese.
It sounds fine in Chinese, right. But I'm talking about the message to the outside world. And one of the reasons why the Chinese government struggles so much to get traction with its initiatives is that, you know, what they have is a failure to communicate.
Right. So, I mean, at least communicate to the jaded, cynical cosmopolitans like you, right? You got a question? Come on up. Point that mic right at you. Yeah, there you go.
Thank you guys again for indulging us, China nerds here in D.C. I have two quick questions. One is, since you guys talk about a lot of contentious issues, have you guys ever received any strongly worded emails from the Chinese government or anyone affiliated with that? And my other quick question is to you, Kaiser. Is there any cool new Chinese metal bands we should be on the lookout for?
I'll take the first question. You take the second.
Okay.
As a podcast, we haven't. My former incarnation as the editor of Dunway, my old website, sadly, the website was blocked and I got hassled by nasty men. But Seneca has never had any kind of problem. And I think there are a couple of reasons. One is we're clearly complete panda huggers who love our motherland. But the other reason, it's in English, usually quite fast conversational English, and it's not easily searchable.
My theory is that anybody whose English would be good enough to be able to understand a very colloquial, fast-paced podcast like this would be too valuable to be tasked with something so minor as to listen to a colloquial, fast-paced English podcast that only lands in English. So that's my operating theory, Swaba. As to metal bands, I mean, I've been gone from China for a year. Things changed really, very quickly. But there are a couple that I think are really good. Suffocated is one of them. They're sort of a thrash band with some deathy stuff going on. There's another one called... I hesitate to full-throatedly recommend them. They have some stuff that is embarrassingly cringeworthy, but they're called Death by Sorrow. Yu is their name. So yeah, those are two I would recommend. And anyone else want to know about metal bands in China? We got another question. Come on up.
Hello, my name is Xiao Heng. I have a question about the legal session. You mentioned that the news Xinhua asked journalists to differentiate criminals and suspect. But on the other hand, like CCTV and other state news organizations sometimes force celebrity suspects to confess their, like, what they did in front
Absolutely.
Of the cameras. So how do you view this?
And then Xinhua runs the CCTV footage on Xinhua's website. So, yeah, I think I did say that, you know, it's progress in at least the way they're talking about it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the change has permeated through society, you know. I think, even in America, right, American campuses are supposedly very politically correct, and it's very easy to offend anybody. But, you know, I live in the South, and a few miles away from where I live, there's dudes with Confederate flags, you know, on their porches, and people who use the most despicable racist language. So, I mean, I do think that the actual, you know, what is going on in society and what is going on inside Chinese media organizations, I mean, the progress is uneven. The fact that there is an awareness that in theory a suspect should be innocent before he's guilty is good, even if in practice that's not the case. And you're right about the TV confessions. I mean, that has been one of the most freaky and alarming things of the Xi Jinping era. And
well,
that was a
2014-15
well,
phenomenon.
It's tailed off a little bit, but it's still going on, and it's horrible. I mean, I've seen people I know twice on TV in the, you know, waistcoat, looking, you know, messed up, confessing to whatever they did. It does feel, you know, very, very uncivilized.
Were they both named Peter?
It's an area of civil society and of law where China still has a lot of progress to make. But that doesn't mean we can't recognize that Xinhua News Agency is at least making an effort.
You know, there's a new television show that's been put out by the state itself, actually. It features corrupt officials, these tigers, actually, who are doing these mea culpas. These people have presumably already gone through the whole Shuanggui system, and they're appearing on camera confessing to their crimes. I think there's a lot of surmise that it's in exchange for more lenient sentencing. That may be what's actually happening here. Let's get some more questions. Hey.
Hello, Kaiser, Jeremy. My name is Robbie Shields. I'm with the Hopkins Nanjing Center.
All right.
Welcome you both to Washington. Jeremy, you just mentioned a little bit talking about you living in the South, living in Tennessee. Kaiser, I know you live in North Carolina. I'm curious, we're in a kind of a unique market here in D.C., right? How have you found moving to the American South to be in terms of the presence of China and the influence in China in the American South, as opposed to a place like Washington, D.C.?
He moved here first, so he gets to go first.
Well, obviously the first greatest suffering is the lack of good Chinese restaurants. So Nashville has two okay Chinese restaurants, and I've had to learn to cook. So that's just my daily misery, and I'm going to cry about it on stage. In terms of the sort of China community, I mean, Nashville, I think it's even smaller than in the Research Triangle where Kaiser lives. There is a tiny American Chinese population that's been there a few generations, scattered around the South, really. There is a slightly newer contingent of Taiwanese and mainland Chinese people who have moved in the 80s and 90s. And now there's a lot of students. You know, Nashville has quite a lot of universities, so there are more and more students from mainland China. But it's still very early days. I mean, we have nothing like this kind of crowd in Nashville. You know, the China events, I'm involved in the Tennessee China Business Network, and we put on events, and I won't tell you exactly how small our crowds are, because this is not the city for talking about how small your crowds are. But then, it's a little tougher than being here. My job, fortunately, you know, Kaiser and I work together online, and I work with a team of editors and you know, the founder of our company, they're all in New York. And we do a lot of stuff online. So I feel, and, you know, with China itself, I mean, you know, WeChat means I feel still in very close contact with my friends in China. But it's early days.
That's right. So I moved to an area that is not very the South in the South. It's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina is where I live. And, of course, down the road in Durham, there's Duke University. And right next door is, of course, the University of North Carolina, both of which have very strong China programs. There's large communities of China-related people, not only people who are China watchers, but also the Chinese themselves. What's been chiefly fascinating to me is to see sort of the lines of schism within that community, especially as I witnessed in the year 2016 during the election. I saw that there was a bright line between people who had come to the community and had been working there, who had been graduate students at UNC or Duke, who had taken jobs in the Triangle at pharmaceutical or IT firms, who had put down roots there and raised children there. They were pretty uniformly Hillary Clinton supporters, whereas the newer immigrants were often quite strident and quite vocal supporters of he whose name shall not be spoken. And it's been interesting, because I've been trying to get active locally in politics. I'm working, doing communications for a town council candidate named Gu Hongbin, who is somebody who came to this country in the early 1990s and is very progressive and a totally wonderful person. Great community of Chinese people, a good Chinese school. And I found an awful lot of interest there in Jeremy and I have been doing. A lot of people who will come up to me and say, hey, you know, I heard your voice just now. I listened to your podcast. I'm really, you know, I heard you'd moved here. It's really great to finally meet you. And it's been really just great to see what kind of an interest there is in the community over, in the non sort of China-focused community in what's happening in China. So I love where I live right now. It's absolutely terrific. I highly recommend it. Come on up.
Hi, guys. I have a question. I was wondering how powerful you believe the attempt to control discourse on a state level, how it trickles down to individual behavior. because I would think in terms of climate change, for example, in the United States, that discourse and affecting people, but relating back to like the Chinhua and like the common Chinese person, kind of.
Yeah, I think there's just no, there's no question that, I mean, look, any one of us who has good friends who are Chinese knows that there will be times in the course of the discussion where you will hit something that smells suspiciously like an unexamined assumption that was sort of an artifact of political education. Whether it's something like Tibet was and always shall be part, and you know, an irreducible part of China, or it's always the various T's, right? Tiananmen and Tibet and Taiwan and things like that, where there's sort of this this irreducible core that I think shouldn't surprise anybody. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think anyone in any society is totally immune to the official discourse, to the controlling effects of it. I certainly am. I'd be happy to admit it. Totally brainwashed by liberal media.
But I think you mentioned climate change. I think that's an interesting example when it comes to China, because I think that actually went the other way around.
Exactly.
And in fact, it's not climate change in China. It's air pollution. It's a different problem, but it's the smog. That's what changed things, you know. And it was really the U.S. Embassy's Twitter box, you know, measuring the air quality on top of the embassy in Beijing, that first made people aware that the stuff you could see in the air was bad stuff. And that was the beginning of a real change, I believe, in the Chinese government's thinking about the environment. Or, you know, perhaps that change had started already, but it certainly accelerated it. And I think part of that change has also been a greater commitment to climate change, because in China it is seen as part of the same thing. You've got to, you know, reduce emissions, and that will hopefully reduce the effects of climate change, but it'll also clean up the air.
Yeah, the same thing as putting hydrocarbons. It's the same hydrocarbon problem.
Right? Yeah. And I mean, you know, one example of the way that it came sort of bottom up, I mean, the famous film by the CCTV host, Under the Dome, which, I mean, okay, she's an establishment person. She was a CCTV news presenter, but it was her own effort, and she may have had some backing from some people in the government, but, you know, the later banning and deletion of the film was pretty clear sign that this certainly didn't come, you know, from the top down. And that film, nonetheless, was, you know, hugely influential. The People's Daily wrote about it.
Well, there was imprimatur. I mean, she had reached so many people in the MEP. There were some there was some senior backing behind that film.
Yeah.
This didn't come from the grassroots.
No, it wasn't a grassroots, but right. It wasn't a state-led discourse.
Right. Great. Next question.
Hi, my name is Ray Winborn, and I work at the Emerging Markets Private Equity Association. Part of my job is to look at venture capital activity in China, and so I've been following very closely the bike sharing wars and the increasingly large fundraising rounds that you're getting from Mobike and Ofo. I'd really like to hear kind of your thoughts on this, the bike sharing and broadly more of the sharing economy companies that we're seeing popping up and getting so much attention in China. Personally, I think it's kind of overhyped. but I just want to know what your thoughts are.
Well, look, I mean, there's no question that it's overhyped. These valuations are—they're absurd. This is the latest iteration of a phenomenon that we've seen many times before in China, and it really goes back. I mean, even before, you could go back to internet video sites in 2007, 2008, where there were literally thousands of YouTube clones. There were literally thousands of Groupon clones of you know, deal of the day sites for a little while. There were tons and tons of companies that were doing what's called O2O, you know, online to offline. O2O was especially an egregious instance of this because, again, valuations were super high, subsidies were enormous, profits were far, far away. All of the participants had the backing of one of the major BAT companies. It was a bloody bay, and the idea was that one big ass shark was going to swim out into the blue water at the end of that, and that it would be. But you know, one thing that we need to remember is market behavior had fundamentally changed because of all of these things. Now, look at after O2O, the percentage of meals that are eaten, you know, through delivery. Look at the number of movie theater tickets that are bought now online. The market, consumer behavior has fundamentally changed, just as it has now with bike sharing. Now, is this an efficient model right now? No, it is not. Is it free of problems? Absolutely not. I mean, you can't even walk down the goddamn street now in any major city without falling over a bike, a yellow bike, a blue bike, an orange bike, whatever. I mean, they're piled up everywhere. Everyone's seen these pictures. But I think in time, it will get straightened out, and it will end up being a good thing.
Also, I mean, bike sharing is solving a very, very real problem that all cities, and particularly Chinese cities, which are big and overpopulated, have. So to me, you know, they may be overvalued, but these companies are solving a real problem. And the reason there are so many bikes and so many people riding them is because it's something people need. Shared umbrellas, on-demand umbrellas, or, you know, the most ridiculous one came out yesterday on Weibo. There was a posting about this company that is installing these mini capsules on the streets of Beijing that are mini gyms. So there's a treadmill inside the capsule. So you scan your smartphone, you get in there. So, you know, you're walking down the street in Beijing, and it's hot and dusty because it's summer. And you're going to want to open a little hot box and run on a treadmill for half an hour. I mean, you know, to me, that's ridiculous. I can't see businesses like that working. Another one that was really funny that has already flamed out was they were calling it a shared sleep space.
Right.
I mean, sharing on demand, I think, is a better word. So, again, little capsule. They put them initially, I think, mostly in Zhongguancun and, you know, the high-tech era of Beijing. And the idea is you can just go and sleep there for half an hour. But I think they've already been forced to close because of concerns about, you know, sanitation. And obviously in China, where you're supposed to register with the police, you know, if you stay in any hotel in China, they're supposed to register your identity documents with the police that day. You know, being able to basically operate a hotel without the system in place was going to get them into trouble sooner or later. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of ridiculous, frothy nonsense, but some of those core businesses are going to be valuable.
So what about in the U.S. is the question. So, I mean, God.
Like, maybe you could try a public bus here first. I don't know, you know. I could see New York, you know, D.C. maybe. You know, where I live, probably not very soon.
Right. It's hilly where I live. So. Good question. Let's bring it. Come on up. So there is something, right, on transsexuals, I think.
In that list? I don't recall it. I don't think there was anything about LGBT issues in that list, but maybe my memory is failing me. I mean, the Chinese press, it depends where you look. You know, the terminology generally, you know, homosexual, 同性恋, is the most common you'll see in state media. And the attitude towards it, I think, you know, varies. I mean, central state media tends to kind of ignore, you know, just not talk about it. Whereas in some of the more commercial media, websites and magazines, it's talked about not that differently from the way it is here.
One of the most popular television hosts of a television show in China right now is an openly transsexual woman named Jingxing, who's a very famous dancer.
Yeah, one of the first, well, certainly the most famous receiver of a sex change operation in China in the 1990s, amazingly
right.
enough.
Friends of both of us, right, back then. We used to hang out with her all the time. So, yeah, I think, you know, that whole discourse is evolving in China. I think it's still quite far behind a place like Taiwan, for example, where gay marriage is about to be made legal. I think, though, moving probably faster than anyone could have imagined 20 years ago. it would have been difficult to imagine, you know, 20 years ago, homosexuality was still considered a mental disease. It was still actually considered a disease, and
it was in the disease catalog, and it was punished as a liu mang zui, like the crime of hooliganism.
Right. There is progress. I don't think it's obviously not as fast as many of us would like it to be. This is an area where I encounter, among a lot of people who are otherwise very politically liberal, a lot of conservatism. I mean, I think sexual conservatism in China, oddly, sometimes you wonder why, but it seems to run quite deep, especially when it comes to LGBT issues. And the media is way behind on this. Good question. Thanks. Come on up.
May I have a question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
You first.
Yeah, work in D.C. in the anti-corruption sector for the FCPA, so policy. So I have a question regarding the next meeting or conference happening in October.
November,
So my question is, could you share some thoughts about the anti-corruption movement and what's your perspective for the next term or next 5 years? And
that's a big question.
Would be, what do you think about the ordinary people or businessmen view about the corruption or bribery, or what do you think? Yeah, just for general.
That's a very, very, thank you. I mean, those are huge questions. Anti-corruption, obviously, look, there isn't a single way to look at it. I mean, the classic formation, you know, the way that this question was often posed by a lot of China watchers was, is this a political purge or is it an honest to God anti-corruption drive? And obviously, I think the answer was it's a bit of both. Now, the other questions are, is this clearing ground for future more sustainable economic growth? Or has this so cowed people and scared them from taking any kind of personal initiative that it's actually a drag on a Chinese economic development? And again, it's a bit of both. I really don't have a black and white answer for you. Jeremy, you want to?
I think the only thing I'd add to that is I first went to China in 1995, and like a lot of ignorant Westerners, the only thing I really knew about China was Tiananmen Square in 1989, Liu Si, and I kept on wanting to ask people about this kind of thing. And, you know, this was 1995. It was a much less free China than it is now in many respects. You know, people, especially slightly older people, were, you know, very, very uncomfortable talking about politics with a foreigner. But the one thing that even people who were absolutely loyal to the Communist Party would always complain to me about was corruption. And I do think that, you know, for a lot of ordinary people, they see the anti-corruption campaign as a, you know, whole absolutely good thing. And I think that's still the case. What it'll mean for the future, I don't want to make a prediction.
Okay, great. You had a question. Please come up. Yeah, let's make one more after you. If there's somebody, if you want to raise your hand. If there are any more. Okay, you'll be the last.
Hi, Kaiser. Hi, Jeremy. It's good to see you again. My name is Michelle. As a Chinese national living in the U.S., I constantly have the feeling that I'm missing out, or every time I go back to China, I feel like falling out of trend. So as someone who's lived in China for many, many years and left, and you guys are here, I was wondering what kind of benefits or upside are you seeing to look into China, looking in from far away, than being right in the middle of it?
I don't see any upsides. I mean, I don't think we have a clearer perspective on it. I think that, like you, we have to struggle with being out of touch not knowing. That's why we take frequent trips back to China. We're constantly, you know, talking to our friends in China to try to keep up. It's a struggle. There's no benefit from being here.
There's been an upside for me. After my website was blocked in 2009, I became increasingly bitter about the Chinese government. And, you know, some other things happened, televised confessions of people I knew among them, and I was becoming one of those nightmare foreigners that you find in China who've lived there their whole lives, and they hate China, and they can't say anything good about China, and yet they stay. And I was in danger of becoming that horrible guy. And leaving has given me the space to, you know, calm down and not take things personally. And I think look at China with a more dispassionately. You know, I mean, even if you listen to the last year or so of our podcasts, I'm going to say a rude word here, but I called the Communist Party a bunch of f***ing c***s, which is not maybe the most responsible thing to do, you know, for a podcast that's trying to examine issues of China very seriously. And I think part of that was a mental condition of being too stressed, and being in the U.S. has certainly relieved me of that.
Yay.
Now he's going to have to do bleeping.
Yeah. We were doing so well, Jeremy. We were really doing so well.
Well, you were the one who promised dirty words at the beginning. We couldn't let them down.
Okay, hey, so hey, thank you all very, very much. We had one more question, right? Yeah, come on up.
Hi, thank you for being here. My name is Yan. Also, I'm a Chinese national. And allow me to disclose that I'm 29 this year. We have touched upon a lot of people, minorities, LGBT community, even Tibetans, Taiwanese. But I wonder if anyone has touched upon gender equality or gender perception in China, especially for women. As far as I know, feminism is not so much of a positive word in mainland China, and a lot of people either don't understand it or treat it as women's efforts to overpower men. So I was wondering, in your experience first, have you ever seen any official language discouraging feminism or any female efforts to not only gain equal rights, but in social levels? Like, for example, I'm pressured into marrying, I'm pressured into giving kids, especially having a second one. And being here is actually very great because I don't have that kind of pressure. But it seems like the feminist trend in China is very not encouraged, and I wonder if you have any opinions on that, and if China's society has some kind of social level of work to do regarding females, not just like rights, but actually the awareness that women are not just about mothers, and their value is more than just being a wife and a mother. Thank you.
Well, I think we have actually done a podcast with Lisa Hong Fincher, who's written a book about
Leftover Women.
Leftover Women, which was a term that, you know, she traces back to the All China Women's Federation, which is the state, a gongo, like the Chinese government's non-government organization dedicated to basically feminism originally. I mean, it should be to uplifting women. And they've been encouraging, later traced back the history of this word. And, you know, she finds that the All China Federation of Women have been encouraging this word, and this word is one of the words that's used to shame women who are 29 and not married, kind of thing. So I think there certainly is some kind of, I mean, this is not the era of women hold up half the sky in official discourse, and I think in a lot of ways women's position has gone backwards over the, you know, over the decades of reform and opening up. But it's quite a mixed thing. I mean, you know, we've done a podcast with Virginia Kamsky, is one of the most successful foreign businesswomen who's operated in China, you know, who talks about how in some ways China is actually a really easy place to do business for women compared to the United States, and especially compared to some other East Asian countries such as Japan or Korea. So I think, you know, you can certainly see the state is scared of activists. You know, the Feminist Five were locked up a couple of years ago for being a little too noisy. And there's obviously fear about activism. I haven't seen a ban on the word feminism that
no,
I can recall.
No, nothing like that. I think, like Jeremy said, it's a very complicated situation. I had the privilege of working very closely with Jennifer Li Xinzhe, who is the CFO of Baidu and a terrific and very dedicated feminist.
She was sort of the Sheryl Sandberg sort of lean-in kind of executive feminism, just sort of that most of the obstacles are in your own mind and you just have to sort of sometimes ignore the structural problems and just sort of power through those, you know, acknowledging that there are structural deep and very, very profound structural obstacles to gender equality in China, but sometimes you need to power through them. Now, one thing that she said to me, which I thought I chewed on for a while and I thought it was really interesting, was that when it comes to China, workforce participation by women was obligatory until really, well, until into the 1990s. Nobody, few women had the luxury of opting out of the workforce. And so this added this very strange dynamic to the whole discourse on women and work, on women and their economic contributions, so that I would frequently encounter women who I would say were, you know, clearly qualify as feminists, who wanted really nothing more than to not have to work, which is a sort of a strange position to find one in. But, you know, given the path of China's economic development, we have to understand that. So it's not possible to simply take our experience here in the West and superimpose that on China and expect to see, you know, identical results. We need to, you know, look at it within its own context. Now, that is not to suggest that we should excuse any of the, I think, the frankly very abominable things that we see. It's still quite routine now when you're applying for a job at a Chinese company to be, well, first be asked to submit a photo before you're interviewed, with your height, your weight, your marital status. None of this would be thinkable in the U.S. It's quite normal for an employer, even women often, who will ask you, In the course of an employment, do you plan to have children anytime in the near future? Do you already have children? Things like this. So these are some of the many structural obstacles that still exist. I mean, they're deeper rooted than that. Look, we still have a bad sex selective abortion problem in China. The gender skew is really, really bad. It's 116 to 100 right now. That is not that does not say good things about the sort of deep gender attitudes in China. So lots of work to still be done, and there's, I think, papering over it and only pointing to the successes is a very bad approach. Well, on that happy note, thank you all for coming very, very, very much. Let's one more round of applause for the organizers, the Winslow.
The organizers very kindly paid for our travel up here, and in order to cover those costs, they would love it if you would drink a lot.
So we're commanding you, drink. Get up there, buy beers, go to the bar, buy some drinks. Yeah, buy me a drink. Anyway, thanks a lot for coming, and we will see you next week on the Civic Podcast. Take care.